We are told that 2,000 years ago, a great teacher walked on the earth. Because he is remembered with such respect today, we believe him to have had exceptional charisma, a Greek word meaning gifts. We are told that he had appealed to large numbers of people, but mostly those who were poor and downtrodden. This is true because his message was in opposition to the practices of the religious and social and economic leaders of his community. It wasn't that he was trying to start anything new. He believed he was conservative. He believed that the Jewish tradition of which he was a part was being violated by the current teachings and practices. And he wanted to call people back to the teachings of the great prophets. He believed, as they had taught, that the creator of the universe wanted people to live in justice and in harmony. In the books of Matthew, Mark, and Luke, one of the stories that is common to the three of them is about a man who came up to Jesus and asked, "Teacher, what good thing must I do to get eternal life?" Jesus responded, "Why did you ask me about what is good? There's only one who is good. If you want to enter life, obey the commandments." "Which ones?" Jesus replied, "Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not give false testimony. Honor your father and mother. Love your neighbor as yourself." "All these I have kept," said the young man. "What do I still lack?" Jesus answered, "If you want to be perfect, go, sell your possessions, give them to the poor, and you will have treasures in heaven. Then come and follow me." When the young man heard this, he went away sad because he had great wealth. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "I tell you the truth. It is hard for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God." Now, a lot of clergy over the years have tried to reinterpret that, and it's all bull. He meant what he said. Or it's all camel. Now, heaven knows, words like these are not the kind that are likely to attract the rich and powerful. In fact, the people in power feared that Jesus was so persuasive that his words about how people should be treated were likely to foment a revolution. And so he was arrested and executed as a common criminal. The people who followed him did not know what to do. His closest followers, we are told, ran away, pretending they didn't know him. But then something drew them back together. They believed that what had inspired them was so important, and so they found then the courage to go about telling of their experience of him and of his teachings, and some of them died for it. And people who heard them told others, who told others. And after a while, all kinds of stories were being told by people who heard from people who heard from people who heard from people. You get the point. As is common in the realm of religion particularly, in time, the stories about the teacher took a variety of forms, the most powerful of which had magical elements. Before too long, he was no longer viewed by most people as a human teacher, but rather the holy having come in human form. And they insisted that, of course, he hadn't really died. He'd been raised up. As the followers created groups to perpetuate his spirit, the maintenance of the groups began to become more important than his teachings. In fact, an elite formed, and his message was massaged so it wouldn't repel the rich and powerful and the support they could bring. The poor were effectively pushed aside, except to the degree that they were assured that if they were to remain humble and obedient, their reward would come later in an afterlife. Now, we know that from time to time over the centuries, teachers emerged who discerned the original message in the preserved stories. One of these was Martin Luther, who was deemed a revolutionary until he decided that he'd had it wrong and he turned on the poor and the downtrodden who had been attracted by his repetition of the stories. He decided instead to take the side of the German princes, who then turned around and slaughtered the poor. Luther was not alone in trying to return to Christian roots, but few such teachers found success in reaching the people without offending the powerful. Jump ahead to our ancestors in the 19th century, in the Unitarian movement in America, whose leaders like Ralph Waldo Emerson, Theodore Parker, and Thomas Starr King stressed their concern for the religion of Jesus rather than the religion about Jesus. Jesus, for them, was not a supernatural figure, but a human one. Parker insisted that just as Euclid's teachings were not great because he had articulated them, so the teachings of Jesus were inspiring, not because Jesus had spoken them, but because, on the contrary, Jesus was important because of the things he had said. Many of the early Unitarian leaders were preaching to the wealthy and powerful leaders in Boston, and a number of them lost their jobs because of their faithfulness to the teachings of Jesus. The rich and the powerful still do not want to be confronted by what Jesus allegedly said. Most of the leaders of the Roman Catholic Church over the years have been institutionalists. I mean, the papacy is, after all, a political position. Most of the 266 popes have been more devoted to the maintenance of the structure of the church and the maintenance of the dogmas than to the teachings of Jesus. It was in 1958, just after my graduation from high school, and I hasten to add my first sermon delivered in the pulpit over there, that the Roman Church and its leaders discovered what they had done in selecting the 77-year-old Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli as a placeholder pope when they couldn't agree on any other candidate. Taking the name John 23, he shook the place up during the not quite 5 years until his death. John believed it was time to take the church into the 20th century, and so he tried to throw open the windows and let the light in. His emphasis was more on liberalizing the structures than on fundamental teachings. It was, however, a revolutionary period, which his successors up till today have tried to recover from. Last spring, the Cardinals chose another 77-year-old, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, to be the Pope. He was the first Pope to choose the name Francis after St. Francis, who is known as the Saint of the Poor. Wow, has he had an impact during the 9 months of his papacy. From the word go, it has been clear that he has a very different vision of the church and of his role as its leader. Now, let me be very clear. There is no sense in which we can claim him as a Unitarian Universalist theologically. You know, we like to go back through history and find people who said things that we liked. We say, well, they were Unitarian Universalists without knowing it. No, he isn't. But there is much on which we find agreement. Francis began immediately by asking the people to pray for him. He rejected the finery of the papacy. He rejected the papal palace, insisting on living in simpler quarters in the guest hotel and taking all of his meals with other priests. He washed the feet of the poor, including a Muslim girl. He suspended a German bishop who was building a multi-million-dollar palace. He telephones common people to express his concern for them. Last month, one day he placed a call to a very small Spanish convent, and when the nuns did not answer because they were at prayer, he called them back. He embraced a severely disfigured man on the street. He goes out nights, we are told, disguised as a parish priest, to minister to the poor. Last week, he made it clear that nursing mothers were to feel free to nurse their hungry babies in the Sistine Chapel during papal masses. If they are hungry, mothers, let them eat. No worries, because here they are the main focus. And now he has fired many of the cardinals who have been mismanaging the papal, the Vatican Bank. And that leads to the center of his ministry. As a true conservative, Francis insists that the church must go back to its roots in Jesus' preference for the poor. At the end of November, the pontiff issued a 50,000-word apostolic exhortation called The Joy of the Gospel, in which he spelled out his vision of the church, his role in it, and his belief of the role of the church in the world. Those who know say that Francis actually is the author of that paper. In it, he proclaimed, "I prefer a church which is bruised, hurting, and dirty because it's been out on the streets, rather than a church which is unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security. I do not want a church concerned with being at the center and then ends by being caught up in a web of obsessions and procedures." About his papacy, he said, "More than by fear of going astray, my hope is that we will be moved by the fear of remaining shut up within structures which give us a false sense of security, within rules which make us harsh judges, within habits which make us feel safe, while at our door people are starving. And Jesus does not tire of saying to us, 'Give them something to eat.'" Now, I want to be clear that I have not read or have not studied all 50,000 words of the exhortation. But I have focused on the 7,500 words specifically addressing poverty and economics, which are central to his message to the church and to us all. Now, what I did was I printed out the important sections, went through with my highlighter, hoping to choose a few things to share with you. I was moved by the depth of his commitment and the articulation of his principles, which are indeed, as I understand it, the principles of Jesus. I highlighted those sections, and I discovered that if I were to stand here and read to you the highlights I found, it would take two Sunday services. And so what I've done is choose the cream of the cream, which is still longer than I consider ideal. I've spent hours trying to cut this down, and here it is, the best I could do. From Francis. "In our time, humanity is experiencing a turning point in its history, as we can see from the advances being made in so many fields. We can only praise the steps being taken to improve people's welfare in areas such as healthcare, education, and communications. At the same time, we have to remember that the majority of our contemporaries are barely living from day to day, with dire consequences. A number of diseases are spreading. The hearts of many people are gripped by fear and desperation, even in the so-called rich countries. The joy of living frequently fades. Lack of respect for others and violence are on the rise, and inequality is increasingly evident. It is a struggle to live, and often to live with precious little dignity. Just as the commandment, 'Thou shalt not kill,' sets a clear limit in order to safeguard the value of human life, today we also have to say, 'Thou shalt not,' to an economy of exclusion and inequality. Such an economy kills. How can it be that it's not a news item when an elderly homeless person dies of exposure, but oh, it's news when the stock market loses 2 points? This is a case of exclusion. Can we continue to stand by when food is thrown away while people are starving? This is a case of inequality. Today, everything comes under the laws of competition and the survival of the fittest, where the powerful feed upon the powerless. As a consequence, masses of people find themselves excluded and marginalized, without work, without possibilities, without any means of escape. Human beings," he says, "are themselves considered consumer goods to be used and then discarded. We have created a throwaway culture which is now spreading. It is no longer simply about exploitation and oppression, but something new. Exclusion ultimately has to do with what it means to be a part of the society in which we live. Those excluded are no longer society's underside or its fringes or its disenfranchised. They are no longer even a part of it. The excluded are not the exploited, but the outcast, the leftovers. In this context, some people continue to defend trickle-down theories which assume that economic growth encouraged by a free market will inevitably succeed in bringing about greater justice and inclusiveness in the world. This opinion, which has never been confirmed by the facts, expresses a crude and naive trust in the goodness of those wielding economic power and in the sacralized workings of the prevailing economic system. Meanwhile, the excluded are still waiting. To sustain a lifestyle which excludes others, or to sustain enthusiasm for that selfish ideal, a globalization of indifference has developed. Almost without being aware of it, we end up being incapable of feeling compassion at the outcry of the poor, weeping for other people's pain, and feeling a need to help them, as though this were someone else's responsibility and not our own. Remember about the flowers getting watered. The culture of prosperity deadens us. We are thrilled if the market offers us something new to purchase. In the meantime, all those lives stunted for lack of opportunity seem a mere spectacle. They fail to move us. While the earnings of a minority are growing exponentially, so too is the gap separating the majority from the prosperity enjoyed by those happy few. This imbalance is the result of ideologies which defend the absolute autonomy of the marketplace and financial speculation. Consequently, they reject the right of states charged with vigilance for the common good to exercise any form of control. Does that ring any bells? A new tyranny is thus born, invisible and often virtual, which unilaterally and relentlessly imposes its own laws and rules. Debt and the accumulation of interest also make it difficult for countries to realize the potential of their own economies and to keep citizens from enjoying their real purchasing power. To all this, we can add widespread corruption and self-serving tax evasion, which have taken on worldwide dimensions. The thirst for power and possessions knows no limits. In this system, which tends to devour everything which stands in the way of increased profits, whatever is fragile, like the environment, is defenseless before the interests of a deified market, which becomes the only rule. He writes, no one can demand that religion should be relegated to the inner sanctum of personal life without influence on societal and national life, without concern for the soundness of civil institutions, without a right to offer an opinion on events affecting society. Who would claim to lock up in a church and silence the message of St. Francis of Assisi or Blessed Teresa of Calcutta? They themselves would have found this unacceptable. An authentic faith, which is never comfortable or completely personal, always involves a deep desire to change the world, to transmit values, to leave this earth somehow better than we found it. We love this magnificent planet on which God has put us, and we love the human family which dwells here with all of its tragedies and struggles, its hopes and aspirations, its strengths and weaknesses. The earth is our common home, and all of us are brothers and sisters. If indeed the just ordering of society and of the state is the central responsibility of politics, the church cannot and must not remain on the sidelines in the fight for justice. He says, the dignity of each human person and the pursuit of the common good are concerns which ought to shape all economic policies. At times, however, they seem to be a mere addendum imported from without in order to fill out a political discourse lacking in perspectives or plans for true and integral development. Business, he said, is a vocation, and a noble vocation, provided that those engaged in it see themselves challenged by a greater meaning in life. This will enable them to truly serve the common good by striving to increase the goods of this world and to make them more accessible to all. I ask God, he said, to give us more politicians capable of sincere and effective dialogue aimed at healing the deepest roots and not simply the appearances of the evils in our world. Politics, though often denigrated, remains a lofty vocation and one of the highest forms of charity, inasmuch as it seeks the common good. We need to be convinced that charity is the principle not only of micro relationships with friends, family members, or in our small groups, but also of macro relationships, social, economic, and political ones. I beg the Lord to grant us more politicians who are genuinely disturbed by the state of society, the people, the lives of the poor. It is vital that government leaders and financial leaders take heed and broaden their horizons, working to ensure that all citizens have dignified work, education, and health care. Why not turn to God and ask Him to inspire their plans? I am firmly convinced that openness to the transcendent can bring about a new political and economic mindset which would help to break down the wall of separation between the economy and the common good of society. And finally, this paragraph. If anyone feels offended by my words, I would respond that I speak them with affection and with the best of intentions, quite apart from any personal interest or political ideology. My words are not those of a foe or an opponent. I am interested only in helping those who are in thrall to an individualistic, indifferent, and self-centered mentality to be freed from those unworthy chains and to attain a way of living and thinking which is more humane, noble, and faithful, and which will bring dignity to their presence on this earth. As I said, there was a lot of stuff there. And I tried and tried, but I just couldn't figure out which paragraph I was going to leave out. And so if you picked up some of it, that's fine. Now, how have the Pope's words and actions been received? Well, we know Time magazine did name him Man of the Year. 90% of American Catholics approve of him, we're told. But on the other hand, Pope Francis has frightened people who have a reason to be frightened. In an interview on CNBC, Kenneth Langone, who's the founder of Home Depot, warned that the feelings of the rich were being so badly hurt that they may withhold their millions from the church and its charities. Langone says that he hopes that in the future, Pope Francis will celebrate a positive point of view rather than focusing on the negative. Rush Limbaugh, as we know, the head of the Republican Party, has not surprisingly labeled the Pope's views as pure Marxism. Did you see the Pope's response? He said, I'm not a Marxist, but in my life I've known many Marxists who are good people, so I do not feel offended. Fox News referred to Francis as the Catholic Church's Obama. God help us. But then on Bill Moyer's TV program, as you might expect, Thomas Cahill commented, I think they're not really afraid of pure Marxism. They might be more afraid of pure Christianity, which is what it seems to me he's spouting. Now, the point of this is that this is not, of course, just a theoretical, theological issue somewhere off there. The economy of the United States is looking more and more like that of a third world nation. The income gap between the top 1% and the rest of us is at historical proportions. The wealth of the Walden family, the owners of Walmart, their family alone has more wealth than the bottom 40% of Americans combined. 40% combined, the six members, or seven, six, I think six members of the Walden family have more. Yes, there has been an economic recovery during the Obama administration. 95% of it has gone straight to the bank accounts of the 1%. The rest of us are barely holding our own. The House Republicans are appalled at the growth in food stamps. They are cutting them back, refusing to understand that there is increased demand for food stamps because there is increasing poverty. People are hungry. They need support to feed their families. They've cut off long-term unemployment benefits, saying that they make us lazy. While the facts are clear, there are 3 job hunters in America today for every available job. What are the other 2 out of the 3 supposed to do? Now, I say us because I actually am among those who just got cut off. I hasten to add, however, it is by no means as devastating to me and my family as it is to many, because our Social Security is not our only source of income. They insist that unemployment benefits make us lazy. They don't acknowledge that we have to prove every week that we have been looking for work and that we've not turned down any job offers that pay within 80% of our previous jobs. The reality is that millions are being made to suffer in order to protect the bank balances and the stock portfolios of the top 1%. The Congressional Budget Office has been clear that the result of the unemployment cutoff is that 240,000 more people are going to lose their jobs because the unemployed can't spend what they don't have, and that money helps to employ other people. In 2011, the CBO found that aid to the unemployment is among the policies with the largest effects on output and employment per dollar of budgetary cost. The unemployed spend their money while the so-called job creators bank theirs in offshore accounts, or they use it to invest in foreign countries, thus failing to impact the American economy in any positive way. Now, I want to acknowledge the insularity of what I've been saying. I've been talking in the American context because it's closest to our experience, but of course it is a global problem, as the Pope pointed out. Robert Calderisi, a former director of the World Bank, pointed out in the New York Times recently, last year the World Bank reported that the number of extreme poor, those making less than $1.25 a day, had dropped in every region of the world, including Africa. But the number of those living on less than $2 a day, 2.5 billion people, or 43% of the population of the developing world, had hardly budged in 30 years. In other words, improvements in public welfare have barely kept pace with population growth, and there is still much to be done to bridge the gap between the rich and poor. Just this week, Oxfam released the results of a study which showed that the 85 richest people on the planet have more wealth than 35 billion of the poorest, which is one half of the world's population. 85 people have more wealth than half of the population of the world combined. Tell me there isn't a problem there. But returning to the United States, I fear that we have a major problem that we are avoiding by putting our heads in the sand. The kind of income gap that we are experiencing is incendiary, and we can readily see where it could lead, and that is not a pretty story. There is more than one reason why the NSA is tracking the phone calls and travels of American citizens. 2 years ago, we were experiencing the peaceful protest of the Occupation Wall Street folks. It's important to understand they did not just vanish. I remember that the district attorney in Albany said, "I will not drive these people out of Academy Park," and then they were driven out by the state. The closing down of these sites around the nation was coordinated by what we call the Justice Department. It didn't happen randomly. Police forces across our nation are requiring tanks and armored personnel carriers, as well as drones. In preparation for what? For bank robbers? John Whitehead, the head of the right-wing Rutherford Institute, in an article that he called "Life in the Emerging American Police State," subtitled It's Time for a Second American Revolution, insists that it remains to be seen whether 2014 will bring more of the same or whether we, the people, will wake up from our somnambulant states. Frankly, reading his article, it is hard to tell whether he is looking at the situation from the left or the right. You know, there really was concern during the Great Depression whether there might be an American Revolution again. FDR was able to institute changes which reduced the gap between rich and poor and therefore reduced the risk. The right talks about President Obama as being a socialist, but the evidence to the contrary is appallingly clear. The stock market has never been higher. As I noted, it's almost exclusively the top 1% who've profited during his term of office. And you can't just point to the Congress. The people that the president put in charge of the economy have been the same people who brought about the recession in the first place. You may have gathered that I'm a little wary. It is harder and harder to be optimistic. And yet Pope Francis is right. He said that when conflict arises, some people simply look at it and go their way as if nothing happened. They wash their hands of it and get on with their lives. Others embrace it in such a way that they become its prisoners. They lose their bearings, project onto institutions their own confusion and dissatisfaction, and thus make unity impossible. But there is also a third way, he discerns, and it is the best way to deal with conflict. It is the willingness to face conflict head on, to resolve it, and to make it a link in the chain of a new process. Blessed are the peacemakers. And he goes on. In this way, it becomes possible to build communion amid disagreement. But this can only be achieved by those great persons who are willing to go beyond the surface of the conflict and to see others in their deepest dignity. This requires acknowledging a principle indispensable of the building of friendship in society, namely that unity is greater than conflict. Solidarity, in its deepest and most challenging sense, thus becomes a way of making history in a life setting where conflicts, tensions, and oppositions can achieve a diversified and life-giving unity. I really have been feeling more and more depressed by the world. I was buoyed, though, significantly last month when we focused on the example of Nelson Mandela, one individual born in a fairly primitive village who demonstrated what can be accomplished under the leadership of one person against overwhelming odds. Today, I want to suggest to you that Pope Francis is yet another source of inspiration. Who can predict what the impact will be of a leader of the Roman Catholic Church who has the courage to point out unflinchingly what we need to do about our world's greatest problems, and who demonstrates his commitment by walking the walk as well as talking the talk? Now, I still cannot imagine myself being able to reinterpret Catholic theology sufficiently for me to be able to subscribe to it. But I have to say that the words and the actions of Pope Francis certainly make it more tempting than it has been ever before in my lifetime. It does feel as if I am in many ways on the same page as the Pope. Are you? So the choices that you made lead us then to hymn number 125, which is from the Crush of Wealth and Power.
waits a spirit silent hour, waiting a poignant call. Bind all my wounds again. Even now our hearts are weary, our much. When I see the pain you carry, shall I with a gentle touch bind all your wounds again? When our love had one another makes our burdens light to bear, find the sister and the brother hungry for the feast we share. Spirits languish, try to draw too near. May we know each other's languish and with love that casts all fear. Bind our wounds.
I note for you that the words to this hymn were written by my first ministerial intern, Kendall Gibbons. Every time our spirits languish, terrified to draw too near, may we know each other's anguish, and with love that casts out fear, bind all our wounds again. Now may the truths that make us free, the hope that never dies, and the love that casts out fear lead us and those we love, and those whom nobody loves, forward together, till the day spring breaks and the shadows flee away. Amen.